The following podcast is brought to you by The Village Zendo. For more information, visit villagezendo.org.
Good morning. And what a gift this silence. And this holding space created by so many caring hands and eyes and hearts. That made today possible. You know, from the Shusos organizing, the registrar, people who accept service positions to keep the time, to sound the bells, the tenzos, the trainers of those in service positions, the outside consultants who or may not even be here who have had input on today's doings. And it seems that all of this is necessary to what? To get us to soften the shell, to relax our guard, our sense of needing to hold ourselves up in the world. And when we can do that, we can come back into remembering who it is we are. So I'm always humbled by how much we need each other to do that. I remember in college they called me affectionately, but still they called me Armadillo. I mean, I don't know if that's still a kind of nickname I'm given, but it gives you an idea of how much armory I carried around to protect this self. And so that's also why I appreciate what it takes to soften. And of course, you know, Zen goes further. It wants to dismantle. In the interests of realizing true nature, who we are. I also appreciate being separated from my cell phone, because it seems I'm incapable of doing that on my own. So Zazen Kai is sort of like, all right, confiscation day. And I thank the gods for decreeing that. So I thought I'd I'd share one of my favorite stories from The Hidden Lamp, which I think points to this whole, it really encapsulates what the Zen enterprise is. And it's called Chiyono, no water, no moon. Chiyono was a servant in a Zen convent who wanted to practice Zazen. One day, she approached an elderly nun and asked, "I'm of humble birth. I can't read or write and must work all the time. Is there any possibility that I could attain the way of Buddha, even though I have no skills?" The nun answered her, "This is wonderful, my dear. In Buddhism, there are no distinctions between people. There's only this. Each person must hold fast to the desire to awaken and cultivate a heart of great compassion. People are complete as they are. If you don't fall into delusive thoughts, there is no Buddha and no sentient being. There's only one complete nature. If you want to know your true nature, you need to turn toward the source of your deluded thoughts. This is called Zazen." Chiyono said with happiness, "With this practice as my companion, I have only to go about my daily life practicing day and night." After months of wholehearted practice, she went out on a full moon night to draw some water from the well. This is, I think, 13th century Japan. So they used lacquered buckets. The bottom of her old bucket, held together by bamboo strips, suddenly gave way. And the reflection of the moon vanished with the water. When she saw this, she attained great realization. And this is her enlightenment poem. "With this and that, I tried to keep the bucket together. And then the bottom fell out. Where water doesn't collect, the moon doesn't dwell." So it turns out this Chiyono is Mugai Nyodai, whose name we chant in the women's ancestor list. And she was the first woman transmitted to in Japan. She founded the first Zen Buddhist convent in Japan. And of course, you know, the striking lines here are this wonderful metaphor of keeping the bucket together, and then the bottom falls out. And of course, we know that's the ultimate fate, isn't it, for all of us? There's no forestalling the bottom of the bucket giving out. And then, of course, is when we realize, oh my God, this is what always was. And so Zen says, don't wait. Don't wait till that moment. Discover your true nature before you die. So we might say practice is a way of helping us towards that letting go, chipping away, chipping away, chipping away, until we can finally let go. And then we know that, of course, life too helps us along the way. We've all had times when we've hit the wall. And realized we can't go on as before. Something has to give. And when that happens, and it's only when that happens that something new can take its place. So let's go through this, koan, line by line. I'm of humble birth. I can't read or write and must work all the time. Is there any possibility I could attain the way of Buddha even though I have no skills? So we see that this is a familiar theme in the Zen annals. You know, the story of Weenang, the illiterate woodcutter who joins the monastery, is sent to the kitchens to sift rice. And the abbot, we find out that his insights are deeper, clearer than the monks above chanting the sutras. And the abbot makes him a successor, tells him to go into hiding because the other monks are in uproar. Weenang becoming an abbot was just as shocking for his contemporaries as having, in our own time, an African-American inhabit the White House. So we see Zen showing us that we have ideas. We have ideas about attainment, who can attain, who's worthy, who isn't. But the nun says, in Buddhism, there are no distinctions between people, which is pretty radical. And another story from the annals, the Emperor Wu of China, who was a great patron of Buddhism and used his wealth to create temples, stupas. And he'd probably read in the scriptures, because there's certainly a lot of mention in the scriptures about the merits that accrue to someone who builds stupas, circumambulates stupas. And even, I think as Roshi can attest, if you go on pilgrimage, I certainly did at Bodh Gaya, if you go, this is one of the things you'll be involved in, circumambulating stupas for hours. And we are a testament to the merits But it's written in the scriptures that those involved in building a stupa, volunteers, patrons who donate funds, organizers, will enjoy some of the following 18 benefits. One, will be reborn in a royal family. Two, will get a beautiful body. Three, will be praised from all directions. Will be inclined to sounds and words of Dharma. Will live only with happiness. Will be reborn in the higher realms of existence. Will quickly reach perfect awakening, and on and on. So, you know, you get the idea. This poor emperor, what, you know, of course, what else is he going to expect? He asks Bodhidharma what his merits are going to be. Maybe emperor forever and ever. And then the crushing answer comes. No merit whatsoever. Vast emptiness. Nothing holy. So here too, the bottom falling out of the bucket. So we see that when the bottom falls out, we become aware that what we believed no longer obtains. Melts before our eyes like ice in the sun. And this can be the gap that that leaves momentarily. Sometimes it lasts longer. It stops. Something. So that what's revealed is a world of pure open potential. And this can be either liberating or terrifying. Elizabeth Warren is fond of telling wealthy entrepreneurs who don't want to pay taxes that their wealth was created by using the utilities paid for by the public. Highways, telephone, lines, computer stuff. So in the same way, she could be channeling Bodhidharma talking to this emperor. I'm sorry, Your Highness, but the temples and the stupas you made couldn't have been built without the back-breaking labor of thousands of slaves who quarry the stone, fell the trees, and the work of hundreds of masons and carpenters. Those laborers were fed and nourished by the work of local farmers and women who brought the food. And all this further made possible by the monsoon rains that watered the rice fields and the sun that dried them. So this is emptiness, isn't it? Interconnectedness, the interdependence of all things. That none of us can stand independently and say, this is what I did. Causes and conditions. They created the emperor and they created Trump. In our current, sorry, polarized political state, only a third of Americans have university degrees. And most career opportunities go to those who live in the metropolitan areas. We're seen by the rest of the country as godless, latte-drinking liberals who support policies that fly in the face of their worldview. These people go to church, have stayed in the places where they were born. They believe in self-reliance, not having the government provide. Not only have they lost the jobs that gave them a sense of identity, but their very values are not being reflected in the direction the world is going. The bottom has fallen out of their bucket. To medicate their pain, they take opioids and support Trump. At least circumambulating stupas gave the poor of the world hope. These people only have Fox News. Some of you may have heard the joke of the daughter driving with her elderly mother. The mother's behind the wheel, she's driving the car, and they go through a red light. The daughter, she's aware of the mother's sensitivity about aging, so she doesn't say anything. Mother goes through a second red light. The daughter becomes alarmed and says, "Mother, do you realize you've gone through two red lights?" And the mother says, "Oh dear, am I the one driving?" Which I kind of feel speaks to the zeitgeist, to the sense of who's in charge here. Is there anyone? Certainly the last week has felt like there are dangerous signs, or the signs of an unraveling that continues, where the center is not holding. And paradoxically, I think it's only when we realize that there is no one in charge that we begin to assume responsibility for ourselves and this world. And it's when practice gets very real, as is clear how high the stakes are, and how we can take nothing for granted. We can't just phone it in. And that again, I think, is something very Zen, you know, again in the stories of the guy at the edge of the cliff. And that we're really asked to live our lives as if we are always at the edge of the cliff. This moment. So in Buddhism, there are no distinctions between people. There's only this. Each person must hold fast to the desire to awaken and cultivate a heart of great compassion. So we cultivate a heart of compassion by what? By sitting with the pain of the world. The despair of the young man in Wuhan sitting next to his wife dying of the coronavirus, worrying, who's going to take care of their four-year-old kid. The pain of persons lost all their belongings, their house in the fires in Australia. Pain of the headmaster in the Midwest who sees all of his students lost to addiction. Pain of the Republican senator who hates himself for being more afraid of Trump than his own life. The pain of the political activist who stands behind a cause and works and gives their all only to lose, to be outvoted. But I think the only way for us to open to the pain and heartache of the world is to open first to our own. To our own grief, to our own fear, to our own anger. And that is not the same as being overrun by fear and anger. So that's the difference. You see, when we bring, and why a day like this is imperative to give ourselves the space to, for all of the stuff that numbs us, to wear off and to actually be with what is here, what we haven't had a chance to metabolize, to sense, to feel, that there is the safety in this structure that allows us to do that essential human work. That clicking on the, you know, the cell phone or, you know, the news things does not allow. Because when the limbic system is hijacked by the fear, by the outrage, by this need to react, this knee-jerk, it's instantaneous, and it goes into overdrive. And this is the workings of the primitive system that goes into fight, flight, or freeze. And it doesn't have access to the higher cortex, which says, all right, let's breathe right now. You are safe at this moment. Let's breathe into so that some possibility of some skillful action can emerge. And that requires reflection, possibly talking to other people, organizing. But allowing our nervous systems to be constantly hijacked by news cycles that give us another reason to worry, and spending our time, you know, as I certainly do, scrambling over other news analysis to see where we are. In the end, doesn't help. Neuroplasticity echoes the early teachings of the Buddha about sankhara, conditioned things or dispositions, mental imprints. In the phrase, neurons that fire together, wire together. So that what we dwell on is reinforced. We look for confirming evidence, and we keep repeating it, and it amplifies and exaggerates. And this is what then we are bringing into the world, into our lives. It's contagious, just like the coronavirus. If you don't fall into delusive thoughts, there is no Buddha and no sentient being. There's only one complete nature. If you want to know your true nature, you need to turn toward the source of your delusive thoughts. This is called Zazen. And then the last, the Enlightenment poem, with this and that, I try to keep the bucket together. And then the bottom fell out, where water doesn't collect, the moon doesn't dwell. So on a collective level, there's a perception, isn't there, that the bottom is falling out of the bucket. Our systems of government are failing us. The economic and political systems are corrupt and unjust. And the greenhouse emissions that our lifestyles are contributing to, affecting the planet. And so that our business as usual, our current mode of being is unsustainable. Something, a lot has to change. And it's not to say, and we have to keep in mind, that they're extraordinary. You know, even though the news focuses on the stuff that's very worrying, it is not telling us about the extraordinary movements towards a more enlightened way of conducting life. Some amazing trends. I mean, the fact alone that meditation is now mainstream. Thirty years ago, that wasn't the case. So we have to see that something is definitely quickening in the consciousness. And that allows us to feel hopeful and optimistic about what's possible and what can be manifested. And so as we consider our practice, and that question, but what do I do? One thing is we can listen to this call to prayer that was made 30 years ago, the UN Environmental Program. They created what they called a Sabbath service for Earth Rest Day. And here are their words. It begins with a call to prayer. We who have lost our sense and our senses, our touch, our smell, our vision of who we are, we who frantically force and press all things without rest for body or spirit, hurting our earth and injuring ourselves, we call a halt. We want to rest. We need to rest and allow the earth to rest. We need to reflect and to rediscover the mystery that lives in us, that is the ground of every unique expression of life, the source of the fascination that calls all things to communion. We declare a Sabbath, a space of quiet for simple being and letting be. For recovering the great forgotten truths, for learning how to live again. And then they follow it with a prayer of sorrow. We have forgotten who we are. We have forgotten who we are. We have alienated ourselves from the unfolding of the cosmos. We have become estranged from the movements of the earth. We have turned our back on the cycles of life. We have forgotten who we are. We have sought only our own security. We have exploited simply for our own ends. We have distorted our knowledge. We have abused our power. We have forgotten who we are. Now the land is barren, and the waters are poisoned, and the air is polluted. We have forgotten who we are. Now the forests are dying, and the creatures are disappearing, and humans are despairing. We have forgotten who we are. We ask forgiveness. We ask for the gift of remembering. We ask for the strength to change. When the bottom falls out of the bucket, our perspective changes. And we realize that in each world, at each moment, a new world is coming into being, and that new world is simply the co-creation of each of our energies, intentions, each of our capacity to stay with a perspective that sees that interconnectedness and that oneness. so that each breath, each thought, each action we take is in the service of that. That's something we can all do.